time to put away the bias, the lies, and deceit, and bring forth real talk from real people about real news. Providing the out loud truth and capturing the essence of a new generation, all in a fast-paced hour. This is Viewpoint This Sunday.
Welcome to another Viewpoint This Sunday. This is Malcolm Out Loud. A lot of top stories, people, a lot of news happening. Some of the big things, of course, G20, meeting with China. Putin, of course, too. Trump had a couple of lines with Putin that sent the media crazy. Quite funny if you watch that from the sidelines. But the big story out of the G20 is going to be China and Xi and Trump, that meeting there. So also, as we approach here Independence Day, America's Survival Guide. This Independence Day, we'll have on Judge Michael Warner. We'll talk a little bit about that later in the program here. Lots of top stories. Let's start off here, please. And let me welcome on here Michael Johns. He's the national co-founder and leader of the Tea Party movement. He's a former White House speechwriter and policy analyst with the Heritage Foundation. Ava Armstrong joins us. She's a political commentator and radio personality here at America Out Loud. Ava is an author who writes about the everyday men and women with a focus on patriotism, which is beautifully said this time of year as we come into Independence Day. So the Supreme Court blocking the citizenship question here. So let me give you a little background on this here. Everybody knows Matt Schlapp here. He says on Twitter, and I quote, "I'm for impeaching the Chief Justice for lying to all of us about his support of the Constitution. He is responsible for Robert's care, and now he is angling for vast numbers of illegal residents to help Democrats hold Congress. Enough deception from GOP judges on the Constitution." Wow. So that is, I thought, an interesting, there was a 5-4 on this one here, which is pretty typical of the Supreme Court. What do you make of this, Michael, this particular ruling here? And what do you agree with that tweet that Matt puts out there?
No, actually, I have a great degree of optimism that ultimately this is going to go back to the lower courts. It may or may not come back to the Supreme Court, and there's really no constitutional objection to having this question added into the census. The question, in essence, relates to the citizenship of those who are being polled, and that's a centrally important question. It also has historical precedent for a long time in both the roughly 1820 to about 1950, that question had been on the census form. It was removed in 1950. So it's really simply reinstating it. No real basis that it should not be included in the Supreme Court's ruling. It found no constitutional objection. It was merely a process related to the lower court really playing out in a more fuller way before it's heard again by SCOTUS.
That's a very good point to make there. But yet, obviously, they're using this as another potential racist card against Trump because the question to be on there or not to be on there. Ava, how optimistic are you? Because the president, now let me also add in here, he says that he is exploring delaying the printing of the census documents. That's pretty aggressive as well. I don't know that he can do that legally, but that was the message that came out of that.
I think this is incredibly important. If you want to know the definition of a constitutional crisis, here you go, right here. We don't know who's voting then, if people are citizens or not citizens. This goes to the very root of our democracy, to the very, electoral college. Everything is around the individual vote. So I just don't understand why people aren't, running around with their hair on fire, because I see this as a big blow.
Well, it also goes to the root of the census. I mean, the whole intent of the census is to count the people, the proper
right.
people who are here. I mean, hello. I mean, that is the purpose of the census. So I don't see how that is racist in any way. But yet that seems to be the argument, Michael, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And I think, this is a great opportunity for this president to actually make some additional reforms on the census form and in government forms generally. For instance, they have long utilized this pan-ethnic group, Hispanics, which you know, having gone to college in South Florida with Cuban Americans, you realize there's really no monolithic group known as Hispanics. I mean, we have Cuban Americans, we have Mexican Americans, we have Dominicans, Puerto Ricans. We really want to get away from this ethnic segmentation of the American people, which there's all sorts of implications behind it that are dated and that are divisive and that are ultimately counterproductive. So I think this administration is on the right path with what they're trying to do. They're going to have to come back and argue this case a little better. They originally did it on the basis of Voting Rights Act justification for the inclusion. There's many other reasons. I think, importantly, the designation of congressional seats and being most important, that this absolutely has to be done correctly. As you correctly point out, if you have illegals counted into these right. states and these regions, you're going to have disproportionate congressional representation to those regions, and that's undermining of our complete democracy.
So the other big story is Nancy Pelosi. Boy, this is getting very colorful, the relationship with Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, and AOC. AOC was not happy that Pelosi had signed off on the McConnell border aid bill. Of course, Chuck Schumer also is in a bit of heat, and a lot of Democrats believe he abandoned them in the Senate. And that has been a very interesting storyline coming out of this as well. But this border aid bill with the, and this is just about humanitarian aid is what this is. The speaker wanted to really tighten the screws and put on some really extra measurement of the, this is really about manipulation. And Ava, this is total manipulation. They don't want to give, they're suggesting to the public and to America, they don't trust this president. They don't want to know, they want to know where every cent or penny is. A lot of this comes back to that border wall and other aspects of our immigration policy and open borders, which of course the entire Democrat Party appears to be for. Interesting, but Pelosi felt she was in the corner, didn't she? And she kind of went along with it with McConnell. That surprised a lot of people.
I think she knows that President Trump will not be impeached. And so she's trying to kind of work with him in a way, or appear to be working with him, I should say, because most of this is high theater. I mean, it's just crazy stuff. But she's trying to pretend she's the leader in the House of Representatives.
But she's not the lady, you're saying.
Right. She's not. It's like a puppet show. It yeah. truly is. That's all I see this as. It's like a pretend olive branch, but yet she has a knife in her hand. I mean, you know, it's just, you know, I don't yeah. trust her at all.
Yeah. You know, AOC was up on Twitter, Michael, and she says, hell no, we're not going to compromise on this. And she was pretty blasted. She's made some pretty blatant statements out there, which again shows that division in that relationship and where Nancy is having a very difficult time. Remember, this is not a young woman as well. And she's in a very difficult role there, which is why when she gets in front of the mic or the camera, she's having a very difficult time with all this confusion and stuff going on. That's not an easy position to be in, is it?
It's not an easy position, period. I mean, she's in the difficult position of having to balance a lot of conflicting political sentiment. The Democratic Party today is a lot more monolithic than it was, say, 20 years ago or so. But it's still, and I think this vote, which was, by the way, not close, 305 to 102,
That's right.
really shows that you've got a sizable number of Democrats who are very concerned about returning in 2020 and being depicted as having done nothing on this border crisis. And the reality is, they've done nothing. They have not allocated the money for the border wall. They have not reformed the immigration policies the president's asked them to reform. And they've done nothing on the issue that they say they champion, the Dreamers. So this $4.6 billion was necessary. You basically are running out of money to be able to house and care for asylum applicants at the border. So it was absolutely right. necessary. And that crisis is continuing to, you know, basically skyrocket. I mean, 144,000 illegals in May, which is, I think, the largest in about 12 years that have been yeah. Caught there.
Well, what's happened now is this whole conversation of the border has become a mainstream conversation, and the whole narrative has completely been hijacked. because, again, if you're watching all these debates we'll talk about in a moment and the left, they are clearly making it very normal, a very normalized program to have open borders and have no rule of law. I mean, this is really, it's not an argument on the left. It is really a way of life is what they're suggesting. And this is not just one or two. This is the entire parade of candidates, I believe, and you can see that with the early debates as well. One other thing I want to touch on real fast here, friends, with the border here. You've seen the story, Ava, with the Ninth Circuit Court coming out, and this was a breakthrough story of the last a day or so, where they are prohibiting the funds from the Pentagon to be used to build the wall. That was another striking decision, and with all the news, nobody's really catching up on that one. But that's it was very striking as well. They strike again by putting their hand on the scale and knocking that down and prohibiting the president from eventually building that wall, isn't it?
Yeah, we have to prohibit the Ninth Circuit from making these ridiculous decisions. I read a lot about this decision, and some of it involves the Sierra Club and, you know, putting a border on, you know, somebody's land, and it might not be, it might not look appealing, or, you know, I mean, these things are just crazy. We're talking about the security of the United States of America. If we cannot enforce our borders, we're not a country.
Well, and that's been proven already for sure here. Let me get on to this other story, the Supreme Court, other big ruling this week, and this was a pretty big victory for the GOP, and surprised some people, is the Supreme Court ruling about the gerrymandering here. Roberts says SCOTUS has no role in partisan gerrymandering. Again, many are calling this a victory for a lot of reasons here. He says, our conclusion does not condone excessive partisan gerrymandering. He says the courts are the wrong place to settle these disputes. Now, Pelosi comes out and says, this strikes at the very heart of our American democracy. And she went on to say after that, this ruling greenlights that unjust and deeply dangerous practice of gerrymandering, which robs Americans of their right to have an equal voice in their government. Michael, what do you say to that on this, these claims from Pelosi and this whole decision? Was it the right decision the Supreme Court did?
Yeah, the irony of them saying that that the Supreme Court has no role in this is that it would never have been in the Supreme Court if it hadn't been for the very liberal activist organizations that had really made a mountain out of a molehill, what is essentially a routine issue. And as I said, I think they're ultimately going to be defeated on this issue. There's no constitutional basis, and that is an important part of this ruling, that the court said they had no constitutional objection to the placement of that question back into the census.
Ava, your thoughts on the gerrymandering here and this comments from Pelosi about striking at the very heart of our American democracy?
Well, gerrymandering has been going on, I think, since the beginning of time, but it depends on who's in power. That's who benefits. I mean, you know, if Republicans are in power, then the gerrymandering will benefit Republicans.
Do you find the Supreme Court is doing a cop-out with these decisions this week, Ava?
I do. Yeah, yeah. I do. Because some of these things are, like I said, they're part and parcel of what make us a representative republic. Mm-hmm. And if they refuse to address these items, then we're not going to be a representative republic much longer.
So let's talk about these Democrat debates. So let me read you a couple of quotes here, Michael, and then tell me what you really think here. But so Van Jones comes out and he says, Beto O'Rourke got his ass kicked last night. So that was his comment there. Matt Schlapp says Joe Biden was lying in a pool of his own blood by the time Kamala Harris got done with him. And then, of course, the one of the night is Marianne Williamson, which was searched pretty heavily. Harness love to beat President Trump. She may have something there, Michael.
I do think that Democrats, to have any real prospect of winning, are going to have a very proactive, positive vision for the future of the country. And that has not resonated at all during the Trump administration. The focus has been on Russian collusion. It's been on deriding and denouncing the president, not cooperating with him, not pursuing bipartisan solutions to really serious problems confronting the country. And that is not going to be a message that you want to go back to your district and run on. I also think, you know, if you look at the debate itself, when on the, at least on the second round of the debate in Miami, that when the every Democrat put their hand up saying that they supported health care for illegal aliens who have no legal basis to be here in the first place, that is such an utterly disqualifying position to be holding and not one that is held by the American people. And that's something that President Trump should be able to successfully really make a centerpiece of this 2020 election.
Yeah, well, he is obviously observing all of this, and he was doing it from afar, from the G20 as well. As he was en route there, he says this. He says, and I quote, "All Democrats just raised their hands for giving millions of illegal aliens unlimited health care. How about taking care of American citizens first? That's the end of that race." That was his comment, Ava, about the his comment about the debate itself here. And, you know, the moderators had put that question out there, and of course, and they actually did that a few times, and all of the candidates were in sync step and raising their hands on that particular point there. That has got to be, I mean, I don't know how you leverage this, but it's got to be one of the most ridiculous points. I mean, how can any American who's struggling to pay their health care right now, I mean, let's call it what it is. Healthcare is enormously expensive to Americans. I mean, this statement has got to be a slap in the face to all Americans, don't you think?
Well, bottom line is Obamacare blew up our medical system. It destroyed our healthcare system. And now we're trying to piece it back together. And that's why it's so expensive. We need to get to the real root of the problem. And that's it. Yet these people want to double down. They want to double down on single payer. And let me tell you something, it won't be Medicare for all. It will be Medicaid for all. Mm-hmm. And there will be long, long lines. And a lot of these people, they don't want to address the reality of it. They just want to pretend, you know, oh, look, I'm giving you another government handout. And this Democrat Party has become radical. It's not there are no blue dogs anymore. There are no moderates. That's what struck me as I watched this.
Oh, yeah.
This is
yeah.
radicalism, you
yeah.
know?
Yeah, yeah. That's a great segue, Michael, to you. You listen to Ava put that out there right now, and I got to tell you here, give me some sort of reasonable explanation back as to the fact that, or convince me if you can, please, that it's not radicalism. How do you size that up, please, the debates?
I think what you heard was a very wow. radical and essentially socialists sympathetic, at least towards socialism agenda. And I mean, and then you had the New York City mayor de Blasio, you know, quoting Che Guevara in his speech down there.
Oh, yeah, I've seen that.
Gloria Siempre with, you know, ever on to victory, which was used in the suppression of people throughout the entire hemisphere. I mean, to Cuban Americans, there are very few greater enemies of liberty than Che Guevara, who was an absolute totalitarian and avowed communist.
Yeah, what a moron, I have to tell you, with all due respect, or really no respect, quite honestly. But to put that out there and not know anything about it, he apologizes afterward, Mike. Ah, I didn't really know.
And that's ridiculous, too. I mean, this guy has a master's degree in Latin American affairs.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. The very decade that I went out with the Nicaraguan Contras, who were fighting the communist government in Nicaragua in the 1980s, mm-hmm. in 84, 2 years later, roughly in 86, I believe, he was down flirting and conversing with the communist regime, which was then supported by the Soviet Union, the Sandinista regime in Nicaragua. So he has a long-standing affiliation both with Latin America and with left-of-center regimes in the hemisphere, and I suspect knew exactly what he was saying.
Yeah. You know, I will say to you both that when you think of a general election and you consider these debates, guys, okay, there's nobody who can say, I mean, this election, this general election coming up right now, we have never seen a general election, no matter who the candidate is on the left, we know who on the right is going to be, but we have never seen an election that would be the extreme disparity between two views or two world views, if you will, than America has ever seen than this election. You agree with that statement, Michael?
Yeah, simply because the Democratic Party has moved so far to the left. I mean, Donald Trump has also, I think, redefine the Republican Party in a way that makes it much more populist, in many ways, much more mainstream. And so I think we have a mainstream president running against a very radicalized, almost uniformly far-left Democratic Party that does, you know, really is disconnected from the sentiments and thinking of most Americans.
You know, I asked that question a couple of weeks ago, Ava, to some folks, and they were saying, like, they thought the ratio difference between the winner and loser in the general election, that Trump would potentially win by 10 points. And I thought, at first I thought, you don't even know what you're talking about. When somebody says that back to me, the general election, he's going to win by, I said, get out of here. That's not, I mean, you don't even know what you're talking about. And you know what? They may be right.
Oh, I believe so. I think it will be a bigger landslide than ever before. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, it's amazing how this is. Ava, let's, this other crazy story here, this last story in the top news I want to talk about is that Twitter comes out and, you know, I was just waiting for this other shoe to drop in the room, actually. Mm-hmm. And to me, this is, but you know, I have to tell you in full disclosure, let me tell folks first this story here and then get both of you to opine. Now, Twitter says it will start labeling tweets from influential government officials who break its rules. Now, who do you think they're talking about, people? Can you imagine who that might be? And so that's putting it out there quickly to put the president in line, as well as anybody else for that matter. As they're cranking down and tightening the screws with everybody else in social media, now they say they're going to do it to the influential government officials. Now, Ava, while this on its face sounds like it could be a real problem and a dumb move by Twitter, it actually could be a hell of an opportunity for free speech, actually, in a weird sort of way. What do you say to that?
I don't see it as free speech. I see it as restricting free speech. And I think eventually Donald Trump, President Trump, will leave Twitter. I'm quite certain of it, actually.
The president may very well, if they start to tighten the screws to him, he's going to be most robust in his conversation, and he may very well leave that social media point at that point, and that would open up other avenues for discussion, I think. That's what I'm saying.
I hope it does happen, to be honest with
exactly.
you.
Exactly.
I've had it with Twitter.
Exactly my point.
Yeah, and I think we've taken some responsibility. I mean, it's so easy for us to point at the left of center media, left of center social media, Silicon Valley, academia, but ultimately, where have conservatives been on this the last, you know, 20 years, basically, as all these institutions have been corralled and taken over by these far left viewpoints. I think that, you know, the time for the blame game is over. There's also a very intriguing regulatory component to this, and that is social media companies are inoculated for the most part from any liability for posts that appear on their platform because they represented to the government that they're a social media company comprised of their membership. Once you start editing and determining who can and cannot be on the platform, what views can and cannot be expressed, you're no longer a social media platform. Now you're a publishing company. And at that point, they lose that liability. And I think it's incumbent upon this administration to begin regulating these entities like the utilities they've become.
Yeah. Amen.
You know, I mean, if your electric company came over to you and said, you know, Malcolm, we don't really like your political viewpoints, we're going to cut off your electricity. It would never be permitted, and they are not acting in ways that are consistent with their current categorization from a regulatory standpoint.
That is really well said, Michael. And again, a lot of news in, if you read between the tea leaves again, came out of the G20 in Japan, in Osaka there in Japan. And you just have to read between. We're going to do that next. We'll read between those tea leaves as Viewpoint rolls on here.
We are the vision of the voices. You can email us at talk@americaoutloud.com.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutloud.com, where the conversation never ends, with 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
The chemistry between the world leaders, the body language, the mannerisms that come out of that. In fact, I'll tell you this much. If we could have a G20 every month, that would probably go a long way to keeping world peace, maybe. I don't know. But it's interesting when you see the world leaders come together, is my point. And, you know, when you have people that are face to face, the chances of coming up with some ideas or resolutions are more potential. I mean, something can literally happen than to have a face off where you don't talk, right? So let's talk about the G20 here. And there are some interesting things that came out of the meeting that may or may not even be reported. So I want to talk about that now. And we'll do it with two great voices here. Captain Stu Swerk is here. He's a retired naval officer, a defense contractor, columnist, and contributor here at America Out Loud. Dennis Santiago. Dennis is an American strategist, a philosopher, patriot. He's focused on strategic warfare, asymmetric warfare, arms control, global stability, and he certainly is a commentator and contributor here at America Out Loud. So President Trump says, and I quote, "We agreed we will not, at least for the time being, be lifting tariffs on China." So that was the one point that, and I don't think anybody really expected the tariffs to be lifted unless something momentous happened, which would have been very cool, but probably likely not, because the team said there's been a disparity and really a lack of communication over the past month plus, you know. But he went on to say that the meeting with Xi went better than expected. Now, Dennis, when you hear that better than expected, I thought, okay, well, that's interesting. Now, the president is always optimistic, I believe, when it comes to these kinds of things. He does have a good personal relationship, but the Chinese, I have to tell you, they are one tough egg to crack. So what went better than expected, you think?
Well, what really went better than expected is that people were pretty much getting ready to go into an all-out trade war between the two countries. And the run-up to this meeting, the negotiators were really dour. The rest of the G20 was worried and was outright saying that if the U.S. and China went into this trade war with each other, mm-hmm. that they feared that their economies would suffer. The World Bank mm-hmm. was putting out words that they thought the global economy would go into a tailspin because of it. So everybody was worried. And the fact that the two countries said, hey, let's go back to the negotiating table is a tremendous relief for everyone around. And I think a tremendous relief for the United States, because when all is said and done, here's China coming back to the table saying, yeah, let's keep talking. And I think part of that is because the Chinese cards were not that strong. They're, you know, they've already had a slight shrinkage in their economy, and they know that their bargaining chips come along with a lot of problems. You know, they're as addicted to this trade between the U.S. and China as anybody else, and in fact, more dependent on it than we are.
And that's an argument I hear all the time, what you're saying right there. Who is it hurting more of? And it just really does depend on the situation here. I want to remember at this moment and remind everybody that President Trump has already put tariffs on $250 billion in Chinese imports this year. Now, the threats have been that they would tax, we could tax another $300 billion. You've got to remember the trade deficit here, people, is 3-1 with China. I mean, it's huge, which is part and parcel of the problem. So China, of course, retaliated with its own tariffs on American exports, because that's what they do there. Stu, when you hear the point that Dennis just makes about the fact that, okay, so everybody take a deep breath. That's what people were hoping, because the stock markets and the World Banks and everybody was watching this very, very carefully. I mean, this could be a tumbling block come Monday morning. And so the question is, I mean, the big question is, in your understanding of China, is this just China stalling again? Is this part of the game for China? Or do you think that Xi has any sincerity in him to make a deal with Trump?
I'm just not convinced that the Chinese are going to roll over to some of the more prickly demands. I mean, some of the real policy issues aren't necessarily economic related. Like some of them have to do with things like intellectual property, which of course does involve technology advances and so forth. Mm-hmm. But there's, you know, the Chinese also have predatory trade practices that basically subsidize their own industry, and they require a certain amount of, call it tech transfer, for those companies that do business in China. And there are some other prickly problems and prickly issues that makes me skeptical that they'll actually change some of their practices. You know, one of their main long-term goals is this thing called Made in China 2025. It's one of Xi's personal projects, if you want to call it that. And what their goal is to change the content of stuff that's made in China from 40% domestically produced to upwards of 70%. So that's going to change how they produce and what they produce and what they demand from companies that come in from the outside to do business there. Their long-term goal is basically economic domination for all practical purposes. Mm-hmm. They want to be the leading export economy in the world. Yeah. And ultimately if they pursue these goals, it'll be very difficult for them to curtail some of the industrial espionage, the cyber espionage that they go forward with to capture intellectual property and technology from the West and so forth. And these are really, really areas that are key concern to the United States.
Yeah, they are. This is very fortuitous that Trump has made China really a big pivotal point of his administration. And he did that before while he was campaigning, Stu, and when he ran for, the two big stories to me when he campaigned were trade and immigration, the border. That's why Donald Trump got elected. This story today we're talking about right now is central to that. You know, when you say they're 40 to 70%, I like the way you set that up a moment here, because, you know, when I was a young boy, I remember we used to talk, a lot of my friends, what have you, everything we would turn over always said made in China, Stu. We always said made in China or made in Taiwan in other cases, but it was made in China, made in China. And we used to sort of, question that. This was as a lad now, for God's sakes, which I'd like to say to you was just yesterday, but that would be a stretch, you understand. But we would look at that and think, wow, everything's made in China. That was back then. So if you look past decades and you see where we're at today, I think that, I just want to take a moment to say, everyone needs to understand and step back a moment how visionary, and this needs to be said, how visionary this president truly is. Because he brought up a sticking point that we've been wrestling with for decades and isolated this as a problem. Had that been ignored further and pushed under the carpet, it would have been a real problem. Stu, you talk about technology there a moment. You're so right with your setup there. What's happening now is this is a very multifaceted, dimensional problem and conversation we're having with China right now. And let me just bring listeners, tell one other point, then I want you to opine a moment, both of you, on Huawei. Talking about technology a moment here. So Xi, one of the big linchpins of this whole G20 thing for Xi Jinping is he wanted President Trump to end this massive pressure from the United States on Chinese communications, on specifically this giant Huawei, in return for Beijing agreeing to, that's the carrot they're holding up there, to a potential trade deal. Now, we've been leading a global effort to stop certainly all of our allies, but to stop nations from using technologies by Huawei. And there's been a lot of arguments on this, guys. And part of it is arguing that the Chinese government is using it as a spying mechanism on citizens in other countries. There's been stories about that. You have 5G technology that is at stake here with two big leaders here. Stu, that sets up really a very interesting chess game. This is really a massive chess game, I think is what I'd call it. So with this whole Huawei and the technology piece that we're speaking about here, how do you see this navigation happening? Because without this Huawei technology thing happening, there is going to be no trade deal. That's for damn sure.
Difficult question to answer. Huawei, makes routers, networks. Mm-hmm. You talked about the 5G comm stuff. There's a lot of talk about them using the technology as a means to gather and collect information and data.
That's right.
Data is what counts here. data on just about everything. Anybody that uses these components and networks is susceptible to having their data purloined. And how we're going to preclude that is by basically proscribing anybody buying Huawei technology. Now, what Trump did is doing over there is he's probably going to allow the Huawei folks to continue to buy U.S. components. But as far as buying Huawei pieces and parts, I just don't see it happening, at least until we get the spying aspect resolved. And that's a difficult technology challenge to do.
Dennis, now, you know how delicate this whole conversation is, because this is right up your alley. You study this stuff with the technology piece and the 5G and what Stu just says there. The sensitivity of Chinese spying, this is one of the biggest things that, I mean, it doesn't really get the highlights that, in other words, this would put this whole conversation of China into perspective if everybody truly understood this Huawei conversation and the technology and the spying and the 5G world domination conversation. What happens here? Because the president has just, this was big news really out of the G20, was the fact that he was going to allow some commerce to happen with Huawei and was going to take a moment to breathe. As long as it wasn't against national security is really what he said, if you read between the tea leaves. Is this a game changer or what?
It's a return to the fact that the way technology works in the world is that, you know, the Chinese, Huawei is actually the largest manufacturer of telecommunications equipment on the planet, right? Mm-hmm. They basically make all of this stuff. So they have a very dominant position. The other thing to remember is that most countries on this planet do not have a respect for privacy in the sense that we know it here in America. So to them, you know, spying on your citizens, collecting information, intruding into what happens in your world is not only legitimate, but it's perfectly legal. So you supply these components to other countries, yeah, they do spy on their citizens, and you know, and that's just the way it is. We have a very different view of where that privacy boundary ends in this country, and we don't like to see that technology intrude into our space. Given that, the other part of what goes on here is that all electronic systems, you know, what you get when you actually hold a handset in your hand, whether it's one of their designs, one of our designs, is the interior components come from subcontractors that supply these parts around the world. And the United States is a very big supplier of these subcomponents that go into these devices. The key chips and stuff like that are designed in the United States, and they are the intellectual property of American companies. We want to protect that because we want our companies to be able to continue to make money no matter which manufacturer puts them in. So what's going on here, as you go back to Stu's made in China, where it's really made in China goals for the Chinese, mm-hmm. eventually they want to be the ones making the majority of those subcomponents so that they don't need a dependency on U.S. suppliers or European suppliers or anything like that anymore. So it's a very complex thing.
So this is the power of what Trump is doing right now. He is playing. You've got to give credit here. He is playing the long game because, and that's unusual, Stu, with any politician here. But clearly, he didn't play to the next general election. I really got to give this one to the president. I mean, just I got to put that out there, Stu.
Yes. I know. To me, the Chinese problem is content of their products. It's intellectual property transfer and the requirements for making that happen for people that do business in China. Another thing is currency manipulation. We don't really talk about that a lot either because it's a very complex subject. And that's an area where Trump and Mnuchin and company are trying to get China to play ball in terms of making the yuan, the renminbi, more exchangeable and more predictable and not subject to the kinds of manipulation that the Chinese government has historically done. Namely, they've depressed currency to make their products more attractive to countries to help stimulate and prime the pump for their export economy. So, you know, we've got to hit all of those topics, and they're all intertwined and very complex, as Dennis has been saying.
Yeah. Well, isn't it, interesting that we're only asking them to play fair? I mean, think about that, people. We're not asking for everything, just play fair. What does fair mean? Of course, fair to them is not quite the same as what we're talking about here. It really truly is remarkable, this whole relationship. And again, it just befuddles me how our dumb politicians have put us in this position to begin with. And I will put that out there as well, because it is in English for everybody to understand. Also at the G20 was some media soundbites and some conversations with President Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Now, Putin, of course, is, I find it just really ironic, the whole thing. I love watching Putin's body language with Trump. It is, if you watch the videos, people, of Trump and Putin, and then you go back and watch the videos of Putin and Obama, you'll get all you got to do is what you don't have to listen, just you can mute the videos, just watch the videos and the body language. You'll get a sense of who is running the show and each relationship. And you can figure that one out real quick. I think the biggest thing is the media soundbite that was thrown out to say, you know, as they're in front of all the world leaders at the G20, and the one of the media heads said, what do you say? Are you going to tell Putin not to meddle in our elections? And of course, the president looks up, and you could just imagine what's on his mind at that moment, people. It's like, are you asking me that dumb question again? You know, but he steps back and then he fires off and he looks and he says, he looks at Putin, says, don't meddle in our elections. Now, listen, the Associated Press ran a headline, Trump jokes to Putin, don't meddle in the election. That was the headline from the Associated Press. Dennis, I got to tell you, it is totally entertaining to watch this stuff play out. But we all know about the elections, and we know about Russia, and we know about Putin, and but they don't give up, do they? It's a soundbite. They have to continue to beat that drum, don't they?
Well, yeah, they do, because, you know, but look at it. I mean, you know, if you see the picture, the two guys are smiling. They're like going, all right, we'll go along with it. What the heck? You know, like, sure, wag your finger at me. They're okay, fine. And, you know, he nods and the whole thing. And what? Yeah. So they get their photo op.
Stu, with Putin and Russia here, I mean, again, everybody knows that is hearing me now that we have made just an unbelievable mockery out of Russian-American relationships. I mean, is this recoverable? I mean, looking at Putin and Trump right now, I think of the importance of Russian-American relationship. Can we recover this relationship sincerely?
I think we can, certainly. I mean, I think the rest of the world is used to the dramatic shifts in American politics, depending on which party controls the White House. They witnessed this for the last 50 to 100 years. Mm-hmm. So they've seen back and forth and back and forth. There's no real consistency over the long haul. Yes, there is. There has been a consistent foreign policy called containment for the Russians when the Soviets ran the show over there, but. And that didn't change too much between the Democrat and Republican administrations. But the fall of the Soviet Union, been going back and forth and back and forth. I mean, just harken back to Hillary Clinton's, when she was Secretary of State, her big reset button. We're going to reset relations with the Russians. Mm-hmm. And that came after the immediate fall of the Soviet Union in 1991-92, when we tried to help jumpstart their economy, but in fact we conducted some fairly I would say almost predatory type of practices that didn't really bring them into the family of nations. We took more advantage of access to some of their raw materials and so forth. So we go back and forth and back and forth, and then there's Obama saying that he can make a deal with Medvedev after the elections.
Right. Yeah.
And so it goes back and forth. Yeah. And for the whole Obama administration, the Russians were pals, basically. Mm-hmm. We're going to do this. We're going to do that. Then all of a sudden, when it became politically convenient in 2016, the Democrats turned on a dime, and suddenly the Russians are the bad guys now, and they're basically monkeying around with elections when they spent a fraction of amount of dollars and threw a handful of people, some GRU officers, and a small tech company, and we're supposed to believe that somehow that little tiny investment is going to affect the votes of 120 million people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's absurd. So
I think that one of the areas that's underestimated with the Trump administration people quite seriously is foreign policy. And I have to say as well to you, sincerely, the brilliance of Donald Trump in foreign policy is very much understated. Big thank you here to Dennis Santiago, Captain Stu Swirk. A brilliant, brilliant analysis, for sure. I like talking about these things and stepping back a little bit with you all to give you a perspective of what's really going on, which is what Viewpoint is really all about. What a powerful program today, I have to tell you. Now, listen, up next here, as we celebrate patriotism and Independence Day in America. So got a special treat coming up here. Judge Michael Warren will join us, and America's Survival Guide, this Independence Day, a special program and really message to all Americans about where we stand right now in our union. We'll be back, friends, with more Viewpoint in just a moment.
The America Out Loud Talk Radio app is on Android or Apple. It's the perfect way to listen in to the new generation of talk shows and hosts who are ready to inform and inspire.
I'm going to ask you to go to thewoundedblue.org. That's www.thewoundedblue.org. That is the website for the organization that is the National Association for Injured and Disabled Police Officers. It is a support organization for these men and women who have given so much in the line of duty. We desperately need your help to raise money to get this movement going. And if you are a GoFundMe-er, go to GoFundMe, look up The Wounded Blue, and you can give there as well. But check it out, please, and also check out our film, The Wounded Blue, on Amazon.com.
To tell you, friends, when you hear that song coming back on, it never gets old. It should leave you paused a moment, or at least with a moment of how beautiful America truly is and how blessed we all are to live in this great nation. And I say it once, I say it a million times. This way I can remind you, but also remind me of how blessed we all should be. So as we now come into another Independence Day in our great country, I want to bring on a special guest now to talk about an interesting message about patriotism a little bit, but also about our Constitution and about our principles. Judge Michael Warren is here. He's always called an American patriot. He was Judge of the Year in 2018. He is an author of a great book, America's Survival Guide: How to Stop America's Impending Suicide. Now, that title should get your attention. And you do that by reclaiming our first principles and history, he says. And by the way, that book is clearly on Amazon, but you can also go to the America Out Loud bookstore for quick reference, right at AmericaOutLoud.com, friends. And when you're in there, you just type in the search bar, Michael Warren, it comes up immediately, and you can purchase his book right there directly through the Amazon folks. And there's a whole lot of books there. While you're at the bookstore, take a look at some of the others that are in there from many of our experts and the beautiful people here that we have on our platform here. I want to discuss with you, what does patriotism, what does it mean? What should it mean to people? And does patriotism, is it being challenged right now in America?
Well, first off, thank you for having me on. It's a real pleasure, especially on the eve of Independence Day. And you ask a great question. And I think when you, and I've researched this extensively, given some speeches on it. And the bottom line is that the traditional definition of patriotism basically just means that it is someone that loves and supports their country. And that if you go back to President Obama, he referred to, you know, that he was an American patriot, just like Greeks were Greek patriots and things like that. And that's fine. But I believe that patriotism in the United States means something much deeper and more profound. And that is a belief in our founding first principles that are articulated in our Declaration of Independence. So we hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, that they are endowed by their creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. That when any form of government becomes destructive to these ends, it is the right of the people to alter or abolish it and to establish new government, laying its foundation such principles and organizing its powers such form as to them shall seem most likely to affect their safety and happiness. Those words from the Declaration of Independence were revolutionary in 1776. They remain revolutionary today, and they elaborate on those founding first principles that make Americans Americans. It's just not enough to say, well, I love the country, but I want to impose a totalitarian state. You know, I want a king. I want a communist totalitarian regime to take. That to me is not being patriotic. To be patriotic in America means that you believe in our foundation. And unlike most other countries, and we're definitely the first in the course of human history, we told everybody up front what we believed and what our country was going to be founded on. So it's the rule of law, unalienable rights, limited government, the social compact, equality, and the right to alter or abolish an oppressive government. That's what makes America, America. It's not, you know, Miley Cyrus and her twerking or Pokemon Go or Fortnite or Twitter and Facebook and all those. It's those, that belief in our founding first principles. If you want to learn more about that, not only can you go to the book, America's Survival Guide, which talks about those, but you can go to patriotweek.org, which was founded by my daughter and I about 10 years ago. Mm-hmm. To reinstill a true sense of patriotism in our country.
Those principles you put out there right now, are those principles in trouble in America?
Absolutely. First off, most people don't know, I will, not just anecdotally, but through studies, you ask people, I just recited the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence. Mm-hmm. I asked my jury pools and high school students and all kinds of other people, you know, what did I just articulate? And usually takes 4 or 5 guesses before you get to somebody will stumble into the Declaration of Independence. That's appalling. This ought to be foundational. Everybody ought to be able to walk out of high school and recite the beginning of the Gettysburg Address, the second paragraph of the Declaration of Independence, and the preamble to the Constitution. To me, those are foundational documents. And the fact that they don't know that that's where it comes from and can't articulate or understand what they are means that we are in deep, deep trouble. Yeah. Most of the attention today does not, this is not a partisan discussion. Mm-hmm. So I don't want people to mistake this partisan discussion, but the idea of unalienable rights, that government comes from God or nature and nature's God, that you're born with these rights, they're not given to you by government, and that the government should be limited in scope and nature as defined by the Constitution, those things are not discussed in the normal political discourse today by both sides of the aisle. I mean, it's taken for granted. The government can do whatever it wants. The federal government can do whatever it wants. Mm-hmm. And that most people take the proposition that they can do what the government allows them to do. That is upside down and dangerous threat to our freedom and liberty.
It's a great reminder for all of us to step back and really truly understand this blessing I talk about all the time. There seems to be a general war out there against patriotism in America. It's become a big conversation, and it's front and center right now at this pivotal time in our history. Now, there's a lot of evidence out there about this ignorance in American history, and to the point that over the last many years, these last several years into the previous administration as well, You're seeing a lot of dismantling of American history. You're seeing statues being toppled, and you're seeing being ridiculed. You're seeing our founding fathers being, they want to take them off of everything. They want to take not only God off of everything, but they want to take the founding fathers off of everything. It sounds to me like they really want to transform the nation. So is this a failure of our educational systems? Is it just a lack of general awareness, poor education of the public? Or are there just political operatives at work here?
I think that there's a broad combination of issues that have clustered together to create this situation. And this is self-imposed, and it is a generational issue. It's really started back in the early 1900s when there was an emphasis in the ivory tower, our higher education institutions, away from facts, away from memorization, and more into themes. And that slowly became the dominant perspective in our universities. Of course, they educate our teachers. So then our teachers became dominated by that, which trickles down to the students. The teachers are also heavily involved in our education standards. And I don't want to lay this just at the feet of the education world, because there are issues with our media, with our general culture. It's very unpopular to sing, except for like country western songs, patriotic songs don't sell. And, how many rappers sing, and I like rapping, but how many of them sing patriotic songs or hard rock and roll? It's alternative rock. Very few. There's some, but, very, very few. So it's, the television culture, the cable shows.
Why has patriotism become so political? I mean, the word has definitely become political. And I haven't seen that before in my life. Why is it so political now?
I think there's two reasons. One, and I will explain that when Patriot Week began, mm-hmm. The Tea Party movement was just kind of starting, and there were Patriot clubs and things like that were just kind of bubbling up, and it was not a political term. Mm-hmm. I think that because of those 9/12 groups and Tea Party groups that proudly proclaimed their patriotism, that people opposed that. Wrongly said, well, if they're patriots, I can't be. Okay. And I've heard people, I've had people literally come up to me when we've been at a festival or something, and I've laid out our Patriot Week information and say, well, I can't be a patriot. I'm a Democrat. And I'm like, no, yes, of course you can be. It's not a political issue. And you're going to tell me that you're going to cede patriotism to the Republicans? Take the brochure and look at it. And they're like, no, I won't. And so some of that's there. I also think, and I somewhat hesitate to say this, that some people view patriotism as being rooted in our founding first principles.
Well, listen, I want to recommend everybody, Judge Michael Warren, to go and get the book now. Just go to AmericaOutloud.com. The bookstore's right there. America's Survival Guide, How to Stop America's Impending Suicide by Reclaiming Our First Principles in History. Independence Day really should be a measurement by all of us to stop a moment and really think about this nation and think about and count your blessings. I say to you once, I say to you many times, living in America at this time is equivalent to winning the lottery of your life. There is no better joy for anybody to really appreciate that. So I think patriotism is a big word today, and it's a word that we need to pull out of the political aisles and embrace it here in America. All types of people, left, right, center, need to understand the beauty of America and this just unique country and what we stand for here, America the Beautiful. I mean, there is no better people, and that's a great reminder for all of us on this Independence Day. What a great show here on Viewpoint. We really thank all of our contributors today. It was a terrific conversations all the way through. Remember, friends, to get behind the platform at AmericaOutloud.com. There is a lot happening there as our writers, authors, bloggers, show host, columnist, everyone around the world continue to bring a message of hope and a message of truth to you. As always, it's time to get involved and get loved.